Thank you, kids, for your singing, for honoring God. Thank you for your diligence in study and prayer and being obedient to your parents and to God. Thank you so much for that. And I want to parrot what was said in the first message, and that is, we've got to do a better job than our forefathers in building a spiritual community. We must do a better job. So that's something to work on. I did also want to thank all of you. My wife said to thank all of you for the prayers, for the cards, for your kindness, for her most recent injuries. I'm always wondering what the next one will be. So far, I hope this is it for a while. We've met our deductible, so I always tell her, I say, go now. And I haven't been sleeping well the last couple weeks. I had a crick in my neck, and I just haven't been able to get it out. I told Mr. Metz that, and he said, well, glad it's not a river. So, a creek, yes, from a different part of the world. Okay, well, let's see if we've got that up there. We do. And let me get my stencil as we begin the book of Romans again, chapter 1, verses 18 through 23. Let's go ahead and read the very first slide here. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So they are without excuse, because, although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Now again, as I did last time, I'll try to put these verses on the slide for the sake of time. So I've got about 50 minutes here. We saw last time in verse 17 that there was a righteousness that was available. And we saw that God speaks at least two languages. There is kindness, there is goodness, there is mercy, and there is wrath. Those two languages at least. And we have access to a righteousness from God. He deems us righteous. He declares us righteous through and by faith. We said as well, as we began verse 18, that we were entering God's courtroom. And we are going to see indictment after indictment after indictment. And we also noted last time, we tried to build a case for why in the world would you want to spend time like this on something like sin? Well, you can work it out. If you look at the book of Romans, Paul gives about 2.5 chapters to this. You divide that into how many chapters are in the book, and you'll see this is extremely important. Extremely important. As I said, if you don't, and if I don't know who and what I am in my human nature and my sin, I'll never, never go to verse 17. I'll never seek a righteousness as Paul says, that is not his own. You'll never do that. Today, we hope to get through verse 23. And we may do that, and surely we will. Okay, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Stop. Wait a second, Paul. Wait a second. You're saying that people, and he uses this word right here. Let me go back. This word right here, all. All. And we made the case last time, that includes everybody. Everybody on the planet. You, me, everyone. And it's against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. But Paul, how can you say that? I hear an objection. How can you say that when they don't all have the truth? They don't all have equal access to the truth. It doesn't seem equitable. So how can you say they're suppressing the truth when they don't know the truth? And how can you say they don't have an excuse when they don't seem to know the truth? That's a big problem, Paul. It's a big problem. And Paul is going to support that statement now with the following verses. He says, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Now, I want to highlight here something that Paul is going to repeat over and over and over again. Look at this. They know. They know. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them. For God has shown it to them. They know. He's shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood, they know. He's shown it to them. They're understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead. So they don't have any excuse. Nobody has an excuse. But he's not finished. Verse 21, because although they knew God, they knew God. They knew God. And then verse 25, it says, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie. They knew God. And even though they knew, they made an exchange. Verse 28. And even as they did not like to retain God, where? In their knowledge. They had Him in their knowledge, but they didn't want to retain Him. They pushed Him out. Who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, there it is again, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death. Verse 18 said, they suppress the truth. That's a clue right off the bat. Because you can't, and that's in the present tense, you can't actively suppress, hinder, push down actively the truth unless at some level you know it. And so Paul unfolds, they know, they know, they know, they know, they know. So far, the logic of the text goes like this. First, God's wrath is presently being revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Second, these ungodly and unrighteous people are suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. Third, these people know God, but do not want Him in their knowledge. Fourthly, these people exchange God for created things. That would be idols, as we will find out later. Fifthly, these people know the righteous judgment of God. And I say that, if you look at verse 32, they know they deserve death. They know that. Six, they not only know, but they approve of others sinning with them. That's in verse 32, which we haven't seen. It literally means they stamp approval on other people sinning. So several times here, Paul says, either implicitly or explicitly, they know God. Now that seems strange, doesn't it? Doesn't that catch you off guard? How can they know God? What is it they know about God? Paul says they know God. Now, how could they know God? How can they know God? Verse 19. Because what may be known of God is manifested in them, for God has shown it. So we have a couple of things. It's manifested in them, and God has shown it to them. Nobody just stumbles upon God. Nobody. God discloses Himself. God reveals Himself. There's no such thing as, I was just looking around, I was looking for God, and I found Him. That doesn't happen. God reveals Himself. God reveals His truth. And then he says, for since the creation of the world. Well, that's a clue, isn't it? How do people know God? He says, since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead. And so they are without excuse. They know God by creation. They know God by creation. They know there is a God. They know He's beyond this world. They know He's invisible. They know He's powerful. They know He's good. They know He's beneficent. He's a giver. He gives rain and sunshine and families and gift after gift after gift. They know that. They know He has a law. And they know if you break that law, it's worthy of death. All people know that. All people know that. Now the word Godhead, it's translated here in verse 20. That's really a bad translation. It's a poor translation. They don't know the Godhead. They do not know the Father and the Son. They do not know that. It's from the Greek word theotes, and it means divine attributes, or it's more of a summary term for the attributes of God. They know He's eternal. They know He's divine. They know He's everlasting. Those are attributes of God that can be known through and by creation. And we'll show that in just a minute. They don't know the Father and they don't know Jesus Christ. Now, keep in mind what Paul's doing in this text. We showed you last time, remember the bookends that I talked about? and how Paul was going to put everybody in the category of sin, whether Gentile or Jew. Everybody goes there. Everybody fits in that category. So remember that as we're reading through this particular section here. He is not saying this is the only day of salvation for all people. He's not saying that. But they do know God. Very interesting. Let's look at the next slide. This proves that it's a different kind of knowledge that they have versus what we have. This is Acts 4:12. There is no salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which people must be saved. And then in 1 Timothy 2:5, there's one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Jesus Christ. So if we read Romans as there is just one chance for all people in the sense of this is it now, this doesn't make any sense. Because billions and billions of people that are dead, there are billions of people on our planet today that don't even know Jesus Christ. They don't know the Father. And if there's one name under which all will be saved, and if they don't know that name and have that relationship, then if that's the case, then they're all damned. Right? They're condemned. And that was spoken about last week about hellfire and our position on that. Biblical position. So I don't think that's the case. Here's another scripture. At that time, Jesus answered, this is Matthew 11:25-27. Jesus answered and said, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you've hidden these things from the wise and prudent and revealed them unto babes. Notice that. What's that word, revealed? It's revealed, it's disclosed. Even so, Father, it seemed good in your sight. All things have been delivered to me by my Father. And no one knows the Son except the Father. So here, I'll draw this like this. Here's the Father on this side, on the left. No one knows the Son. Here's the Son, the Father. No one knows the Son except the Father. And now he inverts this. And no one knows the Father except the Son. And then he goes one step further. Let's say this is you and me. And the one to whom the Son wills to reveal himself. So the Son reveals himself here. And that's how you and I know the Father and the Son. That hasn't happened for the majority of mankind. It hasn't happened. Now, go back a second. What I wanted to say after that was to say that creation is limited in what it reveals. It's limited. It doesn't reveal God the Father, and it doesn't reveal God the Son. It doesn't reveal the Godhead. You can't know that except by special revelation. It's been said there are two great books, the book of creation, which is called general revelation, and the book of special revelation, which is the Bible, the Word of God. And the book of creation, of general revelation, is insufficient to save anybody. It's insufficient. It is sufficient enough to know there's a God. and to know that he has laws, and to know that you should obey those laws, it's sufficient enough to condemn everybody. And Paul says, therefore, there is no excuse. There is no excuse. Now, Paul cites creation, so let's look at what creation does. Creation, in Psalms 19, 1 through 4, look at these verbs. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. This is what creation does. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Creation, like a language, like God speaking through what he's created, is talking everywhere, all the time. And it's declaring, it's showing, it's uttering, it's revealing. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. He says, everybody on the planet. Everybody on the planet. It's gone to the ends of the world. So that would be what Paul says is declared in creation. Now, creation can be further subdivided into, if you look underneath that, creation, then what we call conscience. How do people know God? They know him by creation, and they know him by conscience. That's put in humankind by God. Everybody has that. Now, you can sear it, you can dumb it down, you can push it down, but everybody has one, a conscience. I'll skip over some of this. Let's look at Romans 2, verses 12 through 15, because it does mention this concept of conscience. For as many as have sinned without law will also perish without the law, and as many as sinned in the law will be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. For, notice this, for when Gentiles, who do not have the law, by nature, there's something within their nature. By nature, it says, they have a law unto themselves. And by nature, they do the things of the law, although they don't have the law. They don't have the law. But they have something else. Who show the work of the law written in their hearts, and there it is. Their conscience bears witness, and between themselves and their thoughts, it accuses or excuses. Everybody has that. It's just often pictured as this little guy on your shoulder. That's wrong. You shouldn't be doing that. Everybody has that. Everybody. Now again, one can so suppress the truth that conscience is deadened. That conscience is so dead that right and wrong are very, very difficult to understand. But it's there. It's there. It's just suppressed. Just a parenthetical thought. What must it take to move from this level that is beneath the conscience back to the conscience that there is a God and he exists? It's a question for you to ponder. Close parentheses. But everybody has it. Everybody has it. Look at verse 32 of Romans 1. Who knowing the righteous judgment of God, they know that those who practice such things are deserving of death. Now, this is like a parent who says to a child, you do that, you're going to be punished. Here's the law. You break that, consequences. In this situation, everybody knows God has laws. Now, he doesn't say they know all laws. He doesn't say they know the plan of God. He doesn't say they know Jesus Christ. They don't know God the Father. But they know the laws in part. They know the laws in part. Now, this phrase, the righteous judgment of God, it can be translated in different ways. The ESV says, though they know God's righteous decree. The DLNT says, who having known the regulation of God, mounts his interlinear, though they understand the righteous requirements of God, though they know God's law, the EXB, the righteous decree and the just requirements, and then the voice, despite the fact that they're fully aware that God's law says this way of life deserves death, they fail to stop. This is amazing teaching. It's amazing. Everybody knows. Everybody knows there's a God. He's righteous. All people know he has laws. And all people know that breaking those laws deserves death. It's creation and conscience. But wait a second, Paul. How can you say that all people know by creation and conscience when not everybody acknowledges there's a creator? There's atheists, and they don't even acknowledge there's a creator. Everybody knows, Paul says. They know at least, and we haven't covered these 21 sins that are listed in verses 28 through 31 are worthy of death. They know that. They know God's powerful. They know He's eternal. They know. They know. So, we have conscience. We have a moral sense of right and wrong. But we don't know through creation whom to worship. We don't really know God, although we know enough to say there is a God and He exists. We know that. All people know that. Here's an interesting view of how we human beings are, because we were created to worship God. All of us have this divot, this hole, this pocket in us that drives us to worship. And human beings, they will either worship God or they'll find something else to worship. What are some of the things that people substitute God for in worship? Just name a couple of them. Anything. Money. So here's one. Money. Anything else? What's that? Movie stars. We fill this up here. Somebody said power. We fill that up there. Another one.
Entertainment.
Oh man, that's a big one. That's a big one in our world. Fun. You test yourselves. I've tested myself on that one word. How many times I said, let's go do it, it'll be fun. Why do we say that? Why don't we say, it'll be educational, it'll be a learning experience, I'll learn about God. No, it'll be fun, I want to enjoy myself. That can be a God. That can be a God. Fun. I'll give you another one I thought of. Religion. If we don't worship the God of the Bible, we'll make up our own God. And so you have God over here, and we substitute, and we substitute, and we substitute, and we fill ourselves with all this stuff, day after day after day. And you think about it, what kind of psychosis, what kind of emotional and mental illnesses must result because of this? That we get rid of God, we exchange Him for all these things that we stuff ourselves with and have fun with and honor and spend our time and our pleasure on rather than God. There must be so many diseases on this planet that result from that. A massive amount. That's what we do. And as we mentioned, 1 Timothy 4:12 says we can sear the conscience. We can sear the conscience. Let's read verse 20. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Now, that's an interesting phrase there, the things that are made. I'll tell you the Greek word. It is poiema. Poiema. What do you think that word is translated to into English? Anybody? Poem. It's used one other time in Ephesians 2:10 where it says, we are His workmanship. We are His poetry. We are His poem. Creation is made, and God, it's God's signature on everything. It's His poetic ability to create, and He's writing poetry large all over for everybody to see. For everybody to see. Now, if you walked into a cave and there just happened to be some sandstorm that had hit that cave years ago, and you looked on the side of the cave at the entrance and you saw a letter N, what looked like to be N-O, no. It might just be possible that that happened by happenstance. That happened by an accident. But, when you see something like this, like a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins called Pied Beauty. And pied means like batches, multiple colors, more than one, patches. Look at this, and look at the cadence and the rhythm. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire-cold chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscape plotted and pierced, fold, fallow, and plow, in all trades their gear and tackle and trim, all things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how? Can you make a freckle? With swift, slow, sweet, sour, adazzle, dim, He fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise Him. You see something like that. That didn't happen by an accident. There's someone who authored that. There's someone who designed that. And when you look at creation, the complexity of creation, someone made it. And that's what Paul says. It was manifested to them by the things which were made. It speaks of a designer. Verse 21, although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Two of the fundamental problems of humankind. From every problem in the universe, and we'll discuss this next time, but every problem in the universe stems from that right there. Not giving God glory and not being thankful. They didn't glorify Him as God. That's the sin of irreverence. And they didn't thank Him. The sin of ingratitude. We were created to glorify God and be thankful, to thank Him. I'll give you a couple examples in terms of what God is after. And He will not share His glory with another. This is an example of King Herod in Acts 12:22. And Herod is putting on his kingly apparel. He seats himself. And then he begins talking to the people. And the people were shouting, "It's the voice of a God!" Look at what it says, verse 22. "And the people kept shouting, 'The voice of a God and not a man.' And then immediately an angel of the Lord struck him, because he did not give glory to God, and he was eaten by worms and died." That was so displeasing to God that this man would take the glory from these people that was due to him, that God said, "Your life is over." There's a more powerful example, I think, of this. And that's in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 4, verse 28. This is King Nebuchadnezzar. And he was a great king in Babylon. Notice what it says. "All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. And at the end of 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying to himself, 'Is not this great Babylon that I have built for my royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? I built it. I made it. I'm great. Look at me, everybody. Look. Look, my kingdom. Look at me. Honor me. Give me glory.'" Watch what happens. Verse 31, "And while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, 'King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and 7 times shall pass over you, and you shall know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever He chooses. And that very hour the word of God word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men, and he ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feather and his nails like bird's claws." Grass. We're God. Now why in the world would Nebuchadnezzar become an animal? I'll tell you the reason. It's because he thought like an animal. He didn't give God honor. He didn't give God glory. He didn't use his mind to honor and magnify God. He used his mind to honor and magnify himself. And again, that so displeased God that he was thinking that way, that God made him an animal. Now watch what happens. This is fascinating. Watch what happens when your reason returns to you. Verse 34. "At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes towards heaven, and my understanding returned." He lifted his eyes towards it. He starts looking to God. and not himself. And my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored Him who lives forever. That's the first thing you do when your reason returns. You praise God, you honor God, you magnify God, you treasure God. That's why we think, that's why we have the ability to rationally think as human beings. Otherwise, if we don't honor God, we're nothing but animals. Nothing but animals. And I will tell you, I don't have to go very far, and you don't have to go very far to look around and see all the animals. Due to not giving God His honor and not thanking Him. Verse 21 of Romans. Because, although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were they thankful. But they became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Did you notice they changed? That's probably better translated. Exchanged. They made an exchange. And Paul's logic is they knew God. They knew He existed. They know He's powerful. They know all that. But they said, "We don't want You." And they make an exchange. And they exchange what is incorruptible for what is corruptible. Now I'll tell you what, that's a poor exchange. That's a bad deal. To change what is infinite for what is finite. To change what is limitless to what is limited. That's a bad deal. They changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image like unto corruptible man. Now, a literal translation of that verse is, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man. Let me draw this out for you. Here you have God. It's Genesis 1:27 says that man is the image made in the image of God. So you have God, you have an image, we are made in His image. And it says, I should have drawn that littler. But you have a little version of man. And then you have another one, because it says, if you take it literally, they don't get the first image. They don't get man. It's the likeness of an image of man. It's the likeness of an image of man. That means this here is a copy. That means this is a copy. And that means this is a copy. They've changed the incorruptible God for a copy of a copy of a copy. Well, some translators don't take that as literally. And they put these two together, the image of the likeness of man, instead of adding the third. But regardless, it's still the same concept. They've made an exchange that is terrible. That is terrible. back to our question. How can Paul say that all people know God by and through creation when many people deny the existence of a creator despite the existence of the universe? There's a biochemist, Michael Behe, I think it was 96, he came out with his book, Darwin's Black Box. You can read it if you'd like. It's a good read. Essentially, what Behe is saying is there were times in the past when we would take our microscopes and we would look at cells, and we didn't have the high-powered microscopes, but as the microscopes got more powerful and more powerful and more powerful, what we thought were simple-celled organisms turn out to be very, very complex. He uses an example of the bacterium flagellum, and this little bacterium has a whip-like motor structure for how it moves throughout its environment. It has a rotary shaft. It has like little pistons. It has little rods. It has little seals in it. There's some 50 proteins in this little bacterium, and the absence of one solitary protein kills the entire thing. Which means that it couldn't have evolved gradually. There's no incremental way it could work. It wouldn't survive. It would die. And that's what he calls irreducibly complex. Things don't become simpler as we dive into them. They become more complex. Here's a quote from Aldous Huxley, because we might ask, well, why do people suppress the truth? Why do they do that? When it's evident, God says it's evidence, they know. Look at this. You can hardly believe the words. I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning, and consequently assumed that it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He's also concerned to prove that there's no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. For myself, as no doubt for most of my friends, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. The supporters of this system claimed that it had embodied the meaning, the Christian meaning, they insisted, of the world. There was one admirably simple method of confuting these people and justifying ourselves in our erotic revolt. We would deny that the world had any meaning whatsoever. Suppress, suppress. Suppress, hinder, hinder, hinder. Here's another one from Dawkins, who was probably one of the foremost, at least famed, evolutionists. And these kind of words come out of their mouth. Listen. Biology, Dawkins says, is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. They look at the poema. They see the writing of God. They see His handiwork. They see creation. And they look at it and say, it looks like it's designed, but it can't be. It can't be designed because there is no God. There is no God. No, no. It looks complicated. It looks like it's designed. Well, Francis Crick, in his autobiography, this is quoted from Philip E. Johnson. He was the founder or co-discoverer of the structure of DNA. He was also a Nobel Prize winner. What does Crick say? In his autobiography, Crick says very candidly, biologists must remind themselves daily that what they study was not created, it evolved. It was not designed. It evolved. This is difficult. We look at the poema, we look at creation, and it can't be. It's no. This is very, very hard work. It can't be designed. There's got to be another explanation. Chance, evolution. And why would they do that? They do that because to acknowledge there is a God means you owe Him honor and glory, means you owe Him thanks, and means you owe Him obedience. And nobody wants to do that. Everybody wants to be independent as human beings. We don't like somebody over us. We don't like authority. We want our own wisdom. We want our own way of thinking. We want to be in control. It's called suppression. Vain, empty thinking, foolishness, and darkened hearts. Why? Why? Let me put up another slide here, if I can remember this. Why do we do that? Well, what Paul has outlined has been this. Let me make sure my pen works. Has been this. Here's God. And there is an exchange. They should glorify God. They should thank God. And we should use our reason, our minds. And instead of having darkened hearts, hearts that are open and lit. But there's an exchange because they don't. My pen is missing. They don't glorify God. They don't thank Him as they should. And He said, their foolish hearts become darkened. I used to wonder why there's so many stupid, foolish decisions in the world. I don't wonder anymore. You make this kind of exchange, public policy is horrific. You become foolish, and your mind becomes darkened. And what seems reasonable, what seems wise, is just so foolish. Seems wise to you, but it's not. Back to where we were. Does this apply to us? Colossians 3, verses 5 and 7. Does this apply to us? Is this just for those people who are out there that don't know God and we're above that and beyond that? Colossians 3, verses 5 through 7 says, therefore put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness. Look at it. Every sin in your life is idolatry. Every sin in my life is idolatry. It's displacing God. It's making a substitute for God. and saying, I want this. I want this at this moment more than God. And Colossians, and Paul says, kill it. Put it to death. Put it to death. Because God will not share His glory with another. He will not. And so, idolatry, whatever you think about it, it's massive in our society. It's everywhere. We are so image conscious. We are so wealth driven. We are driven in virtually everything by our desires, which push God out. And we take the very gifts of God and we worship those rather than the Creator. It's all idolatry. Every single facet of it is idolatry. So yes, it applies to every single one of us. Every single one of us. Now, here's a question for you. I said at the very beginning, or I asked a question, are we all just victims of darkness? Or are we responsible for our actions? Look at this text here in John 3, verses 19 through 21. And this is condemnation, that the light is come into the world, and that light was Jesus Christ. And men loved darkness . I say, no. Rather, we are lovers of darkness. Isn't that what Romans 1 verse 18 says? We suppress the truth in ungodliness and unrighteousness. Nobody's a victim. Everybody's responsible. Everybody's responsible. Everybody on this planet. Now, as I said, now is not the only day of salvation. It's not. God has a purpose in doing it this way. I'll just allude to this. You can read this in your own time, but it's stunning. I think it's Romans 11:32. You can read that in your own time. We'll cover it at some point. But God has a purpose in doing all of it this way, to shut everybody under sin. And to drive everybody, to faith, to trust Him, to rely upon Him, rather than our own selves. We are not victims of darkness. We are lovers of darkness. And so verse 20 of chapter 1 says, they are without an excuse. They have no excuse. And we don't have time to put this together, but you think it through. And you can look up the scriptures. God has blinded people. You can find that. The God of this world, Satan, has blinded people. You can find that. Our own sins, our unrighteousness, it deceives us, it blinds us. You can find that. All people are blind to certain things. But nobody has an excuse. All are guilty before God. And I imagine it's somewhat like this. People come up, they're resurrected. We call it the Great White Throne Judgment for the mass of humanity. And they come before God and they say, I didn't know who you were. I didn't know anything about you. He says, no, you knew. I gave you creation and I gave you conscience, a conscience. I gave you that. I manifested myself to you. You chose your unrighteousness. You chose to be ungodly. That's what you wanted. That's what you loved. And the response will be either, okay, I still want to do that too. I still want to do that. I don't want to be under your laws. In fact, they might say, the incorrigibly wicked, I don't like your laws. In fact, you've broken my laws. You've broken my laws, God. And I'm going to condemn you. And I can imagine Jesus Christ saying, away with you. Away with you. There is a lake of fire awaiting you. And that person maybe, in my wry sense of humor, oh, well, I didn't know about that. Now you're talking my language. And God will say, no. No. It isn't because you loved me that you're saying yes now. It's because you hated that. And you didn't want to die. And that's what's driving you. The fear of death. I want you to love me. I want you to honor me. I want you to praise me. I want you to treasure me. I want you to magnify me. That's what I want. And I want it with your whole being, your whole mind, your whole heart, everything about you. Everything. And the other person I can imagine coming in, and he details, and perhaps, as he did the others, shows a video of their conscience and how many times they felt it, they knew it in their conscience, but they pushed it out and said, no, he doesn't exist. He doesn't. And suppressed and suppressed and suppressed. And he plays that video. And this person, on the other hand, drops to their knees and says, I've sinned. I'm sorry, God. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I know why I did it. I loved it. I wanted to do it. But I want to change that now. I want to be something that you want me to be. I want to honor you. I want you to be my king instead of my sins being my king. And I believe Jesus Christ will say to those people, I've got a righteousness for you, verse 17, that is not your own. And you can have for the trusting. Do you want it? And they will shout out, yes, 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 Lord, yes, Lord. Those are the two scenarios in my mind. The last slide, I believe, or the last two. Application for us. I'll ask you a question. For what purpose will you use your minds? Your reasoning ability, your capacity to understand and learn. What do you do with your reasoning capacity and your ability to learn and think? One, glorify Him as God. That's an interesting phrase. Glorify Him as God. There is a sense in which He's glorified. But He's to be glorified as God. The sin of irreverence. Secondly, thank Him. Thank Him. The sin of ingratitude. And thirdly, trust Him. the sin of faithlessness. And fourthly, obey him, the sin of rebellion. So when you walk out of this room, you've got to ask yourself, what am I going to do with my mind? And how am I going to spend my time? As I sit in this chair and think right now, is it about some ball game? Is it about some fun place I'd like to be? Rather than understanding who and what God is and what your purpose for life is. Is it about going to a movie tonight and seeing a movie that you shouldn't even really watch? How are you going to glorify and thank and obey and trust God with your mind? It's a big question. It's a big question. Let's read as we close. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 through 23. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thinking, and foolish, their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Don't make the exchange.